Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, coming to you from San Francisco. You know, it's getting colder here. Of course, we've had an incredibly hot summer. And when it gets cold, 50 degrees is cold for us, cold for me. So many of you in the other parts of the country, the United States or around the world, 50 degrees is probably balmy and you know, you need to wear your shorts or something. But for us out here, it's kind of chilly. I want to make a few announcements. We're in the process of expanding Earth Ancients. We want to do a special program on Wednesday, and we're going to call it Spotlight Wednesday, which is spotlighting new and upcoming authors, as well as research investigators who have been working to uncover mysteries, some of our the people we've had on the show who have asked to be on the show, we just don't have time for. Our archaeologists, our anthropologists, who are working on subject matters that are typically not on the mainstream, and that can be known and unknown civilizations, artifacts, digs, excavations, on things that are not typically acknowledged by mainstream science, as well as items that are part of today's scientific community. But we're going to call it Spotlight Wednesdays. And if you're thinking that's something you'd like to hear, I'd like to hear from you. And you can let me know by just sending me an email at cliff@earthancients.com. Just let me know if that's something that interests you. We're probably going to put together a crowdfunding program at the end of this month into December so that we can fund this new branch of the program. But we want to begin covering more insight, more revelations, more research from new and upcoming people who are not published. Some of them may have recently been published, but I'm finding that one day a week isn't enough to cover the material that is coming up in a number of areas. So again, send me an email, cliff@earthancients. We're now on YouTube. If you like YouTube to listen to the program, you can go to YouTube and punch in Earth Ancients. We have our own channel now. We're working with a London company, and they've created a kind of a fun graphic that you can see, and it opens each of the programs. They're slowly loading in the earlier programs from 2014, and they'll have those as well as some of the newer shows in probably within the next 2 or 3 weeks. So if you're a big fan of YouTube, check that out and let me know what you think. It gives a different audience a chance to hear the program, and that's great. I really like that. I have affiliates around the world, but I don't get a chance always to hear, because they just grab the feed and they post it to their networks. And podcasts don't have any kind of licensing. So this is a chance to really see what people are up to. This is a company that uses YouTube exclusively, and the work they've done is pretty good. So check that out. It's Earth Ancients on YouTube, and it's been up now for, I think it's been up for about a week. So you can see maybe a third or less of the past programs. Big news for the week is Java, Indonesia. Of course, you know that we've had Dr. Danny Hillman on the program talking about Gunung Penang, the pyramid. And I got word from one of his research associates that they had started digging and had traveled about 25 feet into the area that is close to this chamber that they discovered through magnetic resonating. They scanned the pyramid and they found this chamber. And what's interesting about this recent revelation is that not only are they passing down into the chamber, and I don't know yet if they've gotten into this chamber, but this chamber is unique because this is a pyramid that is not typical of a pyramid that we're used to learning about. It wasn't built up from bricks or cut stone. It was built by forming a mountain into a pyramid using heavy stones and aligning them in such a way that a pyramid was created. So as we know, the pyramid was built in various sections, and so far they've dug down and have carbon dated the pyramid to be 20,000 years old, and it's getting older as they dig down. So I posted a photograph of the actual scanned chamber that was picked up through the imaging technology that was used by Dr. Hillman. And I also showed a photo of the diagram of the actual location of this chamber. And this chamber is unique because not only is it curious because of its location, about the first half of the pyramid, about 25 to 30 feet down from the top. But if you remember when we had Hillman on, there is some strange magnetic resonance or emissions that are coming out of the pyramid, and they believe it's from this room. So it's anyone's guess as to what's going to be coming out of there, what they're going to find. But later in the year, close to the end of the year, we'll have Bruce Cunningham out in that area, Java, right there. And we're hoping to get a live feed from him. If not live, then we'll record it. And he's going to describe what he sees as well as send back photographs of this this excavation that's going on. And, you know, it's funny because a lot of people don't really consider this to be a pyramid. And it is a pyramid now that they've done enough of the scans and they've excavated it enough. I say that because it's kind of in the same league as the Bosnian pyramids that we've heard about, in that very, very old people, ancient people, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 years or older, developed a pyramid in a unique style where they chose a mountain for its properties. It seems that the properties or the choice of a pyramid was choosing an area that had naturally occurring electromagnetic pulses from the earth. And it seems like both of these pyramids have that criteria. And And I guess they chose those areas because of the power of this, the amount of emissions that are coming up. So those seem to be the criteria. And then the second criteria is they were in such a shape that they could be formed using massive cement blocks, or in the case of the Java Pyramid, existing heavy weight stones of granite type or similar kind of ignition rock, and formed these structures, and then they were used for, we just don't know what they were used for, but it's obvious if there's emissions coming up, and we know from John Burke's work and his analysis of Mayan temples that the ancients used these naturally occurring magnetic pulses in some form or manner that we don't understand. Now, we do know that the Maya used these emissions to enhance their crop seeds, like corn was an example that Burke used. And when these seeds were bathed in these geomagnetic emissions, it actually enhanced them to the point where they were outstandingly strong. They were very, very fertile and grew, you know, these monstrous corn and other crops. So if that's the only reason that they would build a pyramid, that's pretty good. But it seems to me that's a lot of man hours to build a structure like that just for crop enhancement. My guess is they probably used it for a lot of other things like human being enhancement. I don't know, the sky's the limit. But the interesting thing about the Java Pyramid is that it's in the Pacific area, and it leads one to think about the ancient island of Mu, or as it's known, Lemuria. And if this is a, you know, they really haven't found any kind of scribe writing or any kind of scripts or anything like that. Hopefully they'll get something at some point. But I think there's a link. You know, Danny Hillman wrote a book about Atlantis. He feels that it might be linked to Atlantis, but it feels to it's maybe closer to something like the island of Mu. And we don't really know when that landmass was destroyed or how it was destroyed, but we know that through mythology and various tribal legends that there was an island in the Pacific. And today we're going to talk about people that may have come from that island, and these are known as the Little People. And my guest today are two authors who have written about these little people and their influence, not only on the Americas, the American natives, but possibly other parts of the world. The guests today are Susan Martinez. Dr. Martinez has been with us before, and she wrote a book called The Lost History of the Little People. We had Susan on before. She was with us discussing her other book, The Mysterious Origins of the Hybrid Man. And Dr. Martinez is a writer, linguist, teacher, and she's a paranormal researcher and has a doctorate in anthropology from Columbia University. And my other guest today is Mary Joyce. And Mary is a newspaper writer, a columnist, and she was a Sunday Magazine editor, featured editor, actually. And she wrote an interesting book called Cherokee Little People Were Real. Now, you know, the last couple of weeks we've been talking about giants, and I just thought it was, we should cover all of our bases here. And this program is about little people. And, you know, who were these little people, and how have they left their impressions on us today? Now, are we talking about leprechauns? Are we talking about fairies? Are we talking about human beings is the focus. And I want to welcome both of you, Mary and Susan, to the program.
Hi, Cliff.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Glad to have you both. Susan, I want to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about what you understand the history, a real short history of the little people? You actually go back to the early thousands of years ago in your research. What did you find as evidence for this?
Well, I was listening to what you were saying with interest about the pyramid in Java, and if you will forgive me for answering a question with a question, I would ask you if that Java pyramid was flat-topped or pointed.
It's flat-topped. Yeah.
Okay. Can we talk?
All right.
Okay. That was the, I was hoping, I was holding my breath and hoping you would say that because the date is right, 20,000. The moo is right for that date, and the flat top is right. And when you spent a minute or two asking what they were used for, I started taking notes on what you were saying, because the little people built mounds. They were the mound builders of the ancient time, and they lived on the mounds and in the mounds. They were the, as a general rule, we associate mound builders with American culture of the early time. But this was universal, actually. It was in all parts of the world when they escaped the flood of the continent of Mu. I call it Pan. I've got a new book coming out on that. When they escaped Mu around 20,000 years ago, maybe 24, wherever they settled in the world, they continued to build mounds and live on them.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying that you think that this pyramid in Java, Indonesia, could be have been built by the little people?
Most certainly.
Hmm. Wonderful. Mary Joyce, you have done quite a bit of research on the Americans, the Americas of, and some of the little people that you discovered. What? How far back did you find that they went in your research?
I actually took it from a total different direction. I've got the newspaper background, and when I met one of the elderly gentlemen here in Western North Carolina, I got into a conversation with him, and he said the little people were real, and the newspaper part of me clicked on, and I started asking more questions. And he was a very, very well-respected man, a World War II hero, a pastor in this area, and so I paid attention to him, and he led me to a total of 11 different people that I interviewed. And there was an underground city beneath where the campus of Western Carolina University exists now. So what we've discovered here wasn't that they lived in mounds. They lived underground. In fact, the only there were two what they called Indian mounds on the campus, which eventually were plowed down. The old-timers said that there used to be a tubular hole going straight down the middle of the largest mound. And when they started doing construction on the campus, they found all these little tunnels that connected to that. And the old-timers said that wasn't a typical Indian mound. That was a pile of dirt from digging out these tunnels. So there's been a network of these underground tunnels built. They're all built in real dense red clay. They'll vary in size to some degree, but basically like 2 feet across and 3.5 feet tall, and they have arched tops with which, you know, for engineering purposes, makes it more stable. And so what I've found here is that they totally lived underground, not in mounds. But that could
And what did you what was the evidence of any testing or anything like this in terms of dating? Age of these underground tunnels or any artifacts that came out of these tunnels?
There's I have not been able to get a clear-cut answer on that. The little people here existed before the Cherokee arrived, and the Cherokee originally were in the Great Lakes region, and they migrated here. And little people were already here. And what gets really complicated or confusing is that I have found three different descriptions of little people. When the Cherokee first came here, they saw these neatly tended gardens, but they didn't see any people around. And eventually they discovered these little people would come out of the ground at night and tend the farms or the gardens and take the produce back underground. And they described them as having blue tinted skin with dark round eyes and, you know, obviously short people. But that's only one of three descriptions. I don't know if you want to hear the others now or if you want to go on with
something. Sure, yeah, go ahead.
Another description, which is the most common, is little people that look very much like the Cherokee, dark hair, dark eyes, the same kind of skin color. And the Cherokee people, even to this day, seem very, very loving or appreciative of the little people. And many claim that there are still some in the back parts of the mountains here in western North Carolina. The third type actually looked like a leprechaun and had red whiskers, and the Cherokee didn't like them and would actually try to kill them. And you begin to get indirect support of some of these concepts, even from some old moonshiners from the 1930s, and when they were building their secret still way back in the woods at the top of Cullowhee Mountain, they found a pile of little people bones. And regretfully, they just covered it back up and never told anybody about it until after Prohibition because they didn't want anybody to discover their moonshine still. So those are three quite different descriptions.
Fascinating. Susan, what do we know about the migration from Mu to the state, to the Americas? Is there a trail or evidence from, say, California to the East Coast, or is there various settlements that you've been able to uncover of little people?
Yes. The pattern I found and also found confirmed in some of the best archaeology that I've read is that they entered through Central America and made landfall in Guatemala. I do a lot of linguistic tracing. I call it linguistic archaeology, and the ancient name for the fleet that went off to the Americas was called Guatama. And Guatemala is Guatama with a la at the end. Guatemala, Guatama la. There's a great deal of confirmation of this, particularly in the spread of agricultural products. So the picture is generally that they landed in the Mexico area, Guatemala, and traveled inland, both north and south.
Wow. You know, it's funny you mentioned that because in my research of Central America, in a place, a Maya city called Uxmal, U-X-M-A-L, there's the story of the Pyramid of the Magician, which is one of the only oval pyramids in the world. And the story goes that a magical dwarf built that pyramid overnight. And that's the famous story about this pyramid, and it's a beautiful, beautiful pyramid. Of course, it's in typical Mayan fashion. It's been built in three phases. There was an early phase that they say is maybe 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and then something was built on top of it, and then another one was built on top of that. So there's three different
right.
phases. But I wondered if you could shed any light on that, because that what you're telling me may be may not be a coincidence about that story. Maybe the engineering prowess of these little people are what is how that pyramid came to be.
Well, Uxmal also has the Temple of the Dwarves. And
exactly.
Dwarves is just a it's kind of careless way of indicating little people.
Hmm.
Then there's a duplicate of Uxmal in the Caribbean as well, and the archaeologists found a lot of comparisons between those two.
Interesting. Now, Mary Joyce gave us a...
And there are tunnels. There are tunnels there, too, which Mary Joyce was talking about. There are
tunnels in
the
Yucatan?
In the Uxmal.
Oh, interesting.
Area. And their dwarf magicians did magic acts and so forth in connection with appearing and disappearing in the tunnels. But that's all, you know, been kind of clouded over by mythological elements.
Hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
One of the sad things that I think Susan would agree on is that it's very sad how institutions of learning, going all the way from the Smithsonian down to the small universities, are very much inclined to push aside or even hide information or evidence that doesn't fit into what they believe history should be.
Yes.
And I find that very, very regrettable. I've seen that firsthand dealing with the university here, and it's very sad.
The cover-up has been going on for more than 150 years. The first real mounds excavation that they conducted in America was sponsored by the Smithsonian in 1846 or 7, and they put a lot of work into that. But in finding cemeteries with little people, that part was suppressed. And we tried last year to uncover that story in Coshocton, Ohio. You know, Ohio was the hub of the little people mound building culture in North America. And Coshocton is where 19th century reporters wrote about huge graveyards with very tiny coffins and small-boned people, very, very well-proportioned small-boned people. Well, we tried to, I had a friend in West Virginia who went over to Coshocton last year, and we couldn't find a thing. So it's pretty well buried.
Let me throw something out for Susan. She
sure.
might be able to pursue this. One of the things that I heard from several of the people that I interviewed, and these were all old-timers, and they said that they had found at least one little skeleton in this particular mound, and one of the science professors had a small skull on his desk. He kind of used it like a paperweight, and he just said it was a child's skull. And one day, an English high school teacher came by, picked it up, and looked at it real carefully, and said, "This is not a child's skull. It has all its wisdom teeth." Now, let me put that together. Let me put this together with the cover-up. I talked to a woman who had graduated from the anthropology department from Western Carolina University, and she said that skull, along with two giant skeletons with six toes, were kept secret in the forensic lab at the university. And that's just one example of how there is some evidence, and it is being kept from the public.
Okay, so I'm going to prophesy that the next big breakthrough, in quotes, that we will see in the archaeology magazines in years to come will be a little people and exactly the circumstances that you just described, and then the stuff that's been hidden away in back rooms and museums that'll all come out, and the Smithsonian will swing their banner out, and that is the future of archaeology, if it has any future, the uncovering of the little people. It actually began in 2004 in Java, of all places, where they discovered the Homo floresiensis, which
yes.
were called hobbits in the media. And, well, Cliff, you can tie that in with your Java pyramid. In that case, however, you have to look at the fossil record and understand that there was a great deal of racial mixing in the early time, and that what we have with the hobbits are very short types, but more of the, well, let's say the Homo erectus genes, very mixed in with the original little people genes.
I'd like to jump in with the mixing of the races, and this story I've not told in public before, and that is when my book came out, Cherokee Little People Were Real, there was a lot of local interest in this area, and one of the women who used to come into where I worked said one day, kind of quietly, she said, "I think my granddaughter is a little person." And I'm going, this didn't quite jive with anything that I knew. And she
right.
said, she's Cherokee. The granddaughter is half Cherokee and half Hawaiian. Both of those races have the little people. So it's possible.
The Menahuni.
Yeah. And so it's
yeah.
very possible that the recessive gene came up in this child. And when I met the child, she brought her in to where I worked, and she was she had the shape of a mature Cherokee Indian woman, kind of the rounded shape of the classic Indian, and she was very, very short, and she could just barely look up, above a countertop, and she had a lot of health problems, and she was under the care of a doctor, a specialist at one of the hospitals, which I can't remember which one it is now. And he could never figure out why her immune system was so poor. Well, that made me think, could it be possible that their immune system just wasn't capable of dealing with what was brought into the area at a later time? She eventually died. I think she was only like 18.
Oh.
Wow.
Mary Joyce, I'm not far from you. I'm in the Cherokee.
I know, you're
area.
down in Clayton.
Yeah. This area was known as Stakoa, and it was called the Dividings because so many of the Cherokee paths met here. I'm in Rabun County in northeast.
That's where they would go to get their mates, right?
Sure.
So they wouldn't interbreed.
It may be. Now, I've got a neighbor here about four houses down who is a little person. And I believe she also has those Cherokee genes. They were called Nunehi and Yunwisundi.
And you're much better at pronouncing those than I am.
Well, I'm a linguist.
It's always a problem of mine, too, some of those things.
You know what it looks like, and you don't know quite how to put the pronunciation on it.
Yeah. I do want to mention this theme of historical editing seems to run through any type of humanoid that is discovered. In the last couple of weeks, we've had people talking about giants, and the Smithsonian just keeps coming up in terms of removing complete skeletal remains from excavation sites, taking all artifacts related to a burial site and just picking them up and leaving. And it sounds like the same thing with the little people. There's just no evidence in any museum
I can give you another example that I've seen, you know, here firsthand. And that is, I was contacted by a man who was in college at the university here in right around 1999. And he said that he and some of his buddies were down by the river just goofing off. And the head of security for the university came by, and he had a box that he described as looking a little bit larger than a shoebox. And the head of security actually got engaged with a conversation with these guys because they were curious about what he was doing. And he said, well, they keep finding these little bones when they're constructing new buildings. And so he was taking this skeleton off to be reburied on an ATV trail.
Mm-hmm.
So what? And the motivation for this is they didn't want to stop their construction projects.
Right.
So they simply took them off and buried them somewhere else.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Susan, can you tell us why they seem to be a race or a culture that wants to tunnel? Is that because possibly their ancestors may have dealt with some environmental issues that were unpleasant on the surface, flood, deluge, radiation, or something that would push them underground?
I think the question of tunnels is complex. Yes, it could be environmental. There's some information on that, but I would take as a starting point what Mary Joyce mentioned, that the tunnels were found inside 3.5 foot high tunnels were found connecting areas of the what was it, Mary Joyce?
All of those tunnels, it's a network of them that are where the Western Carolina University is now. Is that what you want to know?
Inside the mounds.
No. No, they were underneath flat ground. There was only 2 mounds reported, and they seemed to be essentially piles of dirt from these tunnels being carved. So they, at least here, it seems like they live totally underground.
Mm. Mary Joyce, what would be the explanation for living underground? What would be your guess?
I know one of the, well, let me tell you this. I interviewed a woman who was the great-great-granddaughter of Solly. Solly is a Cherokee hero. And she said she felt like the little people came from the stars. And, you know, they might not have been able to tolerate the intensity of our sun or the brightness of our sun. I mean, that could be a possibility. But the Cherokee themselves believe they came from the Pleiades, so the star origin is very much a part of the little people and the Cherokee culture.
I would like to add the element of persecution, because when you follow the worldwide history of the little people, you find that at a certain point in time, they were actually genocided. They were completely killed off, except for on the continent of Mu. I think that somewhere in that story is that they kept their homes underground, and just as Mary was describing the agricultural fields and nobody around, and then the people came out from underground to pick their harvest. The other thing is that the original race of little people were white-skinned, and when I say white, I mean white, literally white, and white-haired and yellow-haired, also yellow-skinned, white skin, yellow skin, as well as white skin and yellow hair, 3 feet high. That was the original race. In Oaspe, which I use for some of these histories, they were called Ihins. It's spelled I-H-I-N. And actually, to get a confirmation on that name, you can get that in Japan from the priests who call the earlier race of little people, the Ines, I-N-E-S, but it's very close phonetically to the Ihins, which was the original name of the little people race.
And the descriptions you gave more extensively, but we had all 3 descriptions here, which is very interesting. So this must have been a hot spot.
Yes, and all the race mixing is a simple solution to the different types. And the blue skin that you mentioned also is really just a browner skin person describing white skin, because the blue veins show through them.
Yeah.
I think the concept of blue bloods comes from that, because the little people were the first culture bringers.
Right.
And they were the blue bloods of antiquity.
Hmm. I agree with you.
Fascinating. Right. Can we, Susan, do we know the level of advanced nature? In other words, if they built this pyramid, this Gunung Penang pyramid in Java, Indonesia, that's an advanced culture that has to have an engineering, mathematic, geometric, geometry background. These have to be sophisticated people. And it's funny that Mary would mention that they could have been off-world beings, originating from off-world, perhaps a culture that's thousands and thousands of years older than our own. What do you say about that?
My reaction to the off-world business gets a little deeper into some fairly esoteric subjects. I don't think full-grown interplanetary beings came in spaceships, but I do think that DNA came from an off-world source, and that is where Ihan blood came from. But when it comes to the knowledge, this technology and whatnot, the business of building and agriculture and medicine and astronomy, all these things, I go back to the little people as the first priests and priestesses on planet Earth. They were the teachers.
Even the Cherokee here talk about being taught by the little people when they came here.
Yes. And where did the little people get their knowledge from? They got their knowledge from an angelic source. I spend a lot of time in my book trying to explain this, because this is where you run into the materialists and the problems of the materialist point of view. What I'm saying in the book and what I believe is that these little people were the small sacred workers. That was their title in certain parts of the world. They had direct communication with their angelic mentors, and they got their knowledge for building and for agriculture and what all from otherworldly sources. I don't think that knowledge came down from spacemen in nuts and bolts spaceships. I think it came down in a spiritual way.
Mm-hmm. Mary, what do you say?
Let me throw this out. We have a lot of UFOs in this area. In fact, this whole area is a hotbed of mysteries. We have the UFOs. We have Bigfoot. I'm currently working on a Bigfoot project. We have the little people, and we also have the underground bases that are military-oriented. And some of those seem to be interacting with the UFOs. So I'm not really answering your question. I'm just letting you know a whole lot of that is happening in this one area.
Can I say something about UFOs?
Sure.
UFOs are precisely the starships, the fire ships of the Aetherians, of the same angelic hierarchy that the mortal little people were in communication with.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What artifacts have you discovered that are, you know, traceable to little people? As an example, are there any carvings of beings? Are there any small little people amulets? Are they known for leaving sacred objects that were later prized by either natives or other cultures? Susan, we'll start with you.
Yeah, the answer is yes, yes, and yes. My book on little people is heavily illustrated, and there are lots of figurines that answer to your question. And as far as archaeology goes, in Mexico they have, and Central America, they have the Alux houses. That's spelled A-L-U-X. That is the Central American term for the little people. And almost all of the archaeological sites in Central America have little Alux houses connected with them. The archaeologists sort of write them off and call them shrines and whatnot. But these are like 3 foot tall houses, and they are consistently regarded by the native people in native lore as the homes of the little people.
Hmm. Mary, you actually describe a very interesting artifact in your book that you is called the lead head.
Right.
Now, I found that image. It looked like a leprechaun, actually, but it was very well crafted. And you don't actually give it a date, but it was found in, I think it was 1940 by a young boy.
Yeah, in 1940 they had a huge flood here. I mean, the historic kind of flood. And it washed away a tremendous amount of soil. And this little five-year-old boy found this medallion-shaped, what he called a lead head, because the metal was so heavy. And it had a face that absolutely looks like a leprechaun on each side of it. And it has a seam around it, so it was molded. It seems to fit in with the leprechaun image. And in my book, I have a photo of that, and right next to it I have a leprechaun face, and you can see how close the similarity is.
Was that metal analyzed at any degree, or was it taken and scientifically evaluated?
Right. The man that I refer to as a boy, the five-year-old boy, he is still alive. He still has it. He is so protective of it that he won't part with it. I was very fortunate to be able to get a photo of it. And
yes.
I hope he has a plan to move that on to somebody who can do something with it when he passes on. But right now, he's just an old mountain man, apparently, who wants to hold on to it. And his stud, according to him, they've not been able to identify the metal. But I can't vouch for that.
Mm-hmm. Did it look unique to you when you saw it firsthand?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Did you pick it up?
It was more convincing. I didn't touch it.
Okay.
I just got to look at it.
Yeah, because the picture you show is pretty amazing. I'm definitely going to be posting this image. If there's anything like a leprechaun, that's pretty damn close to a leprechaun.
The same man who originally let me know about the lead head also came in one day to show me a little Earth Mother figure. That's the little stone figure where the hips are huge. And he said that they found that at about 250,000 years ago, as far as the depth of the soil was. So
Where did they find it? I didn't hear. Where did they
find it? In the same area. A lot of this happened along the Tuckasegee River, which flows, you know, right through Jackson County. So much of this is in Jackson County. And also Judicola Rock, which is a huge petroglyph stone. I measured it one day. It's roughly 20 by 15 feet. It has all these glyphs all over it. Nobody has been able to decipher it. It existed before the Cherokee, so the Cherokees don't have a clue. And it's speculated that this stone was carved by the little people.
Hmm. You know, it's fascinating. We have this evidence of very, very old cultures living in the Americas, and yet they're not discussed in any history books. They're definitely not going to be in National Geographic, because that would throw that whole place in array. But to hear what you're describing accounts for a whole different period in our history, probably a period that is so old that they were taken out by asteroids or some massive event that would basically halt their evolution, and then we're all kick-started again. And so, you know, here's a culture that had appears to have had advanced metal making. This image that you showed, Mary, it looks like a die cut.
Yeah, it does.
That I would say it was cut from a masterpiece, and which, you know, is indicative of an advanced culture. So it's just fascinating.
The mounds that the Smithsonian dug up, and other mounds as well in the central part of North America, had metallurgy and batik weaving and glass making and astronomical charts, and none of those were connected with the Indian tribes. They were all prior to the Indians, but they were not acceptable to the powers that be, because everything here was supposedly pure Indian before the arrival of Columbus.
Well, I'm very, very optimistic that programs like yours, Cliff, and the books that Susan is, you know, has done and is doing, and people who've, you know, written the books about the Smithsonian hiding the giants, I think this is going to keep bubbling up, and it eventually will burst forth, and it will be recognized. I think we all of us need to keep doing what we're doing.
But the same powers that be are going to call it their own breakthrough.
Yeah. Well, but
I'm telling you.
Yeah, Mary, you can probably, both of you can probably hear, understand what I'm about to say. What happens is that these guardians, I will call them, of the knowledge slowly die off. And the knowledge is prevalent enough where it's on the surface enough that new people come in this place, younger, new researchers, new librarians, so on and so forth. And it's like, why not reveal this to other people? Now, that's on the academic side, the education side. I think there's also a government side also that is potentially kind of blocking the road. And I think that we all hope that eventually this information comes out, because it's so valuable. And it is a part of our history that needs to come out, that needs to be discussed, especially when you find megalithic tools and artifacts that are sophisticated that throw a wrench in our recorded history. But I guess the bottom line is that you might even say the church has something to do with this too.
Yeah, it's like the institutions all have an agenda.
The government wants us to be spinning our wheels about spacemen and nuts and bolts, spaceships from ETs and so forth, because there are two sources of UFOs. One are the fire ships, which I mentioned before, of the Aetherians, and the other is secret government projects.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we clearly have both in this area. I mean, it's some of them are clearly man-made, and some of them, you know, probably aren't. So, yeah, there's a lot of confusion. An awful lot of the UFOs are man-made. There's no doubt about it.
They want us spinning our wheels about ancient astronauts.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting. Susan, do you believe that this these little people is a missing link in human evolution? I mean,
absolutely.
The amount of work that you've done, would you say that, and to my mind, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I don't, and I did a little research before we started this program, I don't think there's one institution that has a complete skeleton on display of a little person.
Or of the giants.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. After I wrote The Little People, I wrote a sequel, The Mysterious Origin of a Hybrid Man. Mm-hmm. And basically I dumped on the whole Darwinian theory of evolution, and I claimed there was no evolution at all. There was only the mixing of races, which accounts for every different type we find in the fossil record.
Fascinating. So, and again, you've looked at it from a global perspective, and where would this little guy go? I mean, it's hard to say because we don't have an age for him. Like, it couldn't be a Java man. It couldn't be, you know, we don't know where
I'm
it
not,
fits. In fact,
I'm not
in fact,
sure that they have all died off. My book first came out about the little people, I spoke at the library in Cherokee because I wanted to announce it where the Indians live first. And there were a number of, elders there. And because they realized that I was open about the little people, they didn't clam up, which they typically do with white people because they don't want to be laughed at. But several of them came up to me afterwards and told me stories about where they are still seeing little people in the remote areas of the Cherokee Nation.
There are enclaves all over the world. We call them pygmies in Africa, but they're all over the world. And the little people genes are basically what makes up the Caucasian stock. Only we have the highest.
Now, would you classify the pygmies as a offshoot of the little people?
Absolutely. That's where they got their shortness from. They got their dark skin from the native, indigenous African type. But then when the fleets came over from Mu 24,000 years ago, there was more mixing in Africa, more racial mixing in Africa than in any other part of the world. That's in the Bible known as Ham, you know, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham landed in Africa. And those races are entirely mixed. If your head will be just spinning if you read the racial mixtures in Africa. They're so varied. But the height, the shortness was maintained in the enclave of Central Africa, the Congo.
Interesting. Now, I'm going to just say this. It's a loose definition for the typical height of little people. It looks like 3 feet is the average. And when you say you believe that pygmy tribes are offshoots, I think they are around that height. So maybe...
No, they're taller than that.
Are they taller than 3?
The pygmies of Africa are, yes.
They're 4 feet and change, but that's because of the racial mixing.
Okay.
The ones here,
the Bushmen, you'll find 3 foot tall.
Okay.
I have photos of them.
Okay.
In southern Africa, in the Kalahari.
So that's more the typical of the original. If there is an original, I mean, we're talking 20,000 plus years of interbreeding and mixing and whatever. But 3 feet was somewhat of the average. And that's
count on it.
Yeah. I mean,
and the tunnels here are 3.5 feet tall. So that would support that.
Okay. 3.5 feet tall. Okay. That makes sense. Now, again, Susan, we do not have any evidence of a complete skeleton being photographed from the 1800s like they did it with the giants. I'll post this out to both of you. Do we have any visual evidence of a skeleton?
The mummies. We have natural cave mummies like the San Pedro man. You can go ahead and Google that. That's in Wyoming and in other locations as well in North America and elsewhere. Mummies that are actually less. There was a dwarfing at one point in time where the people became diminutive and then they went extinct. And so the San Pedro mummy, which is verified at Harvard as genuine, is 14 inches tall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mary, in your book, you describe a giant petroglyph. And apparently it's thought to have been created by little people. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
That's the Judicata rock that I mentioned a little bit earlier. And it's the one that has the glyphs all over it that nobody has been able to decipher. And it was here before the Cherokee migrated here from the Great Lakes region.
What's the approximate size of this?
I went out there and measured it. In rough figures, it would be roughly 20 across and 15 feet
okay.
in the direction.
Okay. And do we know if it was...
It's the largest petroglyph in North mm-hmm. Carolina and one of the largest in this part of the country.
Okay. Now, what has been found on this petroglyph that is unique? It has symbolism is what the picture shows, but have they deciphered anything?
Nobody has been able to figure it out, and there's been a lot of people who've worked on it. So I certainly don't have an answer to give you. It's just a big mystery. And the mystery gets bigger because it's named after, the Cherokee named it after the Judicata giant, and who was known to be able to leap across the mountains. Well, on the website that I do, which is called skyshipsovercachers.com, I've done stories with a number of people who have had experiences with or at least sightings of Bigfoot in this area. So my own personal ongoing theory is that the Judicata giant of Cherokee legends was actually a Bigfoot. And if Bigfoot
wow.
can continue to hide out from people, then it should be very easy for little people to hide out from the rest of civilization if they don't want to be seen.
So you've seen this petroglyph up close and personal.
Yes, I have, absolutely.
Okay. Would you say it was designed to be viewed from the ground or above ground?
Above ground. And
okay.
I lean toward the idea that it was like a teaching blackboard.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
might be a map of some kind, or maybe perhaps a code or some writing that provides some kind of information.
People have speculated about it, you know, part of it being a star map. It's not that clear. I mean, you just don't know what was behind what they were doing. And people
mm-hmm.
much smarter than I have not figured it out yet. It's very interesting, though. The last time I was out there, I noticed something I hadn't ever seen before, and it's not usually included in photos. And in the lower right corner of it, there are two round, it's been carved. It's like round little stools or seats. And when I saw that, it made me think even more that that was a possibility, that that was like a teaching blackboard.
Teaching blackboard. Okay, I ask that because there are noted petroglyphs that are so big that there's no way you could see them from standing on the ground. They were made to be seen above ground, meaning flying mm-hmm. above ground or floating above ground or whatever to take it all in. So
that wouldn't fit in that category, no.
Okay, so this is more that it's more like a table.
It's a slanted. It's a slanted. Yeah, it's
mm-hmm.
a slanted table, really.
Okay, that's fascinating, and I saw that in your book, and I definitely find that quite unusual. Susan, do we have any other examples of petroglyphs that are attributed to little people?
Oh yeah, there's some in Colorado. The medicine wheel markings. They have the crow. Indians talk about their teachers, the little people. But let me add that I believe that the petroglyphs should be interpreted as a ritual information, ritual guidelines, if they were created by the sacred tribes who were the little people. But that the later petroglyphs that were created by the offspring and mixed offspring of the little people, including the Indians, were more pragmatic as to the location of water and tribal territories and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. It's interesting that there is some examples of smaller people, but it seems to me, and I've discussed this before with other authors and researchers, that the Earth goes through various climatic changes, either because it's closer to the sun or further away from the sun. And there's some people that believe that there have been catastrophic events, either through asteroid hits or things like that, that have pushed the Earth closer or further away from the sun, which would cause a gravitational change. And also there's environmental considerations that would probably damage the people who were currently living comfortably on the Earth. Is it your belief that, and both of you can speak to this, that the little people may have died out because of environmental conditions, or was it more that they were hunted because they were different and they caused problems? Go ahead. I'll start with you, Mary.
Probably all of those reasons. Human beings are known for not liking things or people that are different, so that could be part of the reason. There could have been an asteroid or something that made a major climatic change. Let's see, there's got to be more reasons than that.
Cliff?
I mentioned about the little girl that her grandmother brought her in, and she was supposed to be a little Cherokee person.
That's
and
a good
she
example.
She died at a very
yeah.
early age, and, you know, we've had situations where regular tribes of Indians have died because they've been exposed to European smallpox. So
right.
there could have been that aspect to it also.
Right.
Can I give a counterpoint to that?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
In Ecuador, in I think Loja province, there's a enclave of little white people. I wish I could remember, but they don't have a tribal name. There's just this village. There's about 300 of them. There's a wonderful video online, but you'd have to look in my book to find the reference. This is a counterpoint to what Mary pointed out. These people came to international notice about 8 or 10 years ago because they don't get diabetes and they don't get cancer.
So
genetic testing on them to see what the magic ingredient is, I guess.
Right.
That is interesting. In the few minutes we have left, I want to send this out to each of you. I'd like to know what evidence has been found from the little people, and the evidence would be in their influence on other native tribes, or suggestions of building and leaving references to other people. Now, it's funny because after listening to you, Mary, I'm beginning to think that the Maya may have had, and the Maya, to my knowledge, were one of the most culturally rich and diverse cultures out there, and we see it in their carvings and in their artwork. Different, we have Caucasians, African, Asian, and even some very unusual races that have probably died out. Long heads, round heads, very unusual humanoid types, and it feels like it. Probably the little people were part of it, and I've seen it in evidence with various ruins, very small. Tulum on the Caribbean coast, right off the Caribbean coast, is a very unusual ruin that has very small temples that only a small person could get into. Anyhow, the question is, what references do we have? What evidence do we have of cultural exchange? And I'll start with you, Mary.
I wish I could remember the name of it. There is a pyramid, which Susan probably knows about, that's in Georgia. And there are relics that have been found there, or artwork that clearly looks like it's Mayan. Right now, I cannot think of the name of it. It's not too far off of 75, and it would be northwest of Atlanta. Are you familiar with that at all?
Etowah?
It doesn't sound right. Anyhow.
In Cartersville?
Yes. Uh-huh.
That's the Etowah Mounds.
Okay, and that's where they found clearly artwork that looks Mayan.
Now, when you say a pyramid, it's not a typical pyramid. You're talking about more of a mound that has an opening that people can come into?
The ones that I'm aware of are flat top.
Oh, flat top.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when you say pyramid, is it a stone pyramid?
And Susan lives in Georgia, so she probably can address that better than I.
I've never been there.
You haven't? Okay. All righty. Well,
okay. So, Susan, what do you feel on in terms of cultural exchange and any evidence left or discussed from other cultures?
I don't know what you're getting at.
Well, I mean, it's like here are these little people who obviously have advanced knowledge, you know, probably a long history of developing technology, science, and so forth.
Right.
Are there any tribes or any people that say that their technology came from these people, was handed down to them, or any exchanges of culture, science, and technology?
Yes, but you know what? They ended up calling them gods. It was a process of deification after they went extinct. They went extinct on this hemisphere about 3,500 years ago as a group. You know, their DNA is still in the gene pool. It's floating around there, but as a race, they went extinct. And the process all over the world was deification, and so they became the gods. That's why so many of the gods you look in Peru and Mexico are figured as these tiny little things, tiny little creatures with large heads that are obviously based on the little people. The process of deification has a name. It's called euhemism. And this occurred all over the world, and that's how we lost the history of these people, because they were mythologized.
Fascinating. This has been a wonderful look at little people that I didn't have a clue. I mean, I didn't know that this was a culture, a race, a number of races that were sophisticated. We don't know where they originated. We have some speculation, but Mary, what is the greatest influence that you felt from your research and knowledge of these little people?
The reason I did the book was not because I intended to write a book, because I didn't. I realized that nobody was recording this information, and I was talking to people who were mostly in their 80s and some in their 90s, and I wanted that information recorded before they all disappeared. And what I've done with the book is I've taken those transcripts and I have them just the way they were spoken, for the reason that maybe some archaeologists will find a little hint or some clues in something that's said that might not have made sense to, you know, sense to me in the beginning. And that was one reason. Number two, since I've lived in Western North Carolina, I've become friends with quite a number of the Cherokee Indians, and I wanted to give validity to their stories. And so when a white person comes forward and does a book and says, hey, there's real evidence that these little people exist or existed, and I did it for them. I did it for the future, because you hate to see information just disappear forever. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I've deliberately gone back and gotten photos and maps, and you know, it's full of clues if somebody wants to pursue this further that would have the archaeological wherewithal to really do a good job.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I really do enjoy your book. Susan, how about you? In your book, The Lost History of the Little People, what was the greatest impact on you?
It jump-started the next book where I wrote about Darwinism and the entire history of the human race on the planet, and found that also to be very much at odds with what we've been taught. And the bottom line is that the first civilization on Earth was produced by the little people.
And I've done something on the website, again, at skyshipsovercashers.com, and from what I was able to piece together in the article that I posted is that I think all of us originated from Pan or Mu or Lemuria, whatever name you want to use. Whether that means we were all little people, I don't know. But there's convincing evidence. Even the ruins off of Japan, the Yanaguni structures. They're the oldest structures in the world, and that would have been on the north side of Pan or Mu or Lemuria, and that's concrete evidence, you know, when something that is that old, and it's right where this ancient civilization is. And another thing, which I know you've done, Susan, much more extensively than I, but I spent some time finding all the place names all around the Pacific Ocean that have P-A-N in them. And I came up with at least 52. And
Japan, for sure.
Oh, yeah, that's a good start. And in India, there's all sorts of names that have P-A-N in them.
Panajandrum.
Uh-huh. And, you know, it's just phenomenal.
Pandit. That's where you have your spiritual teacher. Pandit is really, it's pronounced Pandit, and it comes from Pan.
And the king that's Pandu, who's mentioned in the Sanskrit book, and I probably will mess up the name of it, Mahabharata, is that something like that? And
Mahabharata.
Thank you very much. And that's, you know, just more proof that the civilization just split out from this one core, and I think we all originated from there.
That's amazing. Let's hope that the predictions that we've discussed of knowledge being opened, that this ancient information is one day going to be available to a larger audience, and that we don't have to dig it up and hope we're right, because the bones are evidence and the skeletal remains and the artifacts are all on display, will be available someday. It'd be wonderful to know the true history of the world.
And I have to throw this in, because it's something I'm working on right now with other people. And we've got an active Bigfoot investigation going on, and we have just recently started what I call a Jane Goodall approach to Bigfoot. And we are having success putting out fruit on a path where we've found these 16-inch footprints. We've also learned that they like music, so what we've been doing is playing a wooden flute when we arrive to deliver the fruit, and then they know we're there, and it's we're hoping it will go much further than that. But again, that is something from our ancient history, and alive, well, and kicking in the mountains of North Carolina. We have to be careful. We're not giving precise locations where we're finding this, because there are too many people who are barbaric hunters who would just as soon have a trophy hanging on their wall. And I think that these Bigfoot are more like cousins than they are creatures just to be hunted down. But
that's funny.
And if people want to follow that, on skyshipsovercachers.com, we don't just deal with UFOs. We do a lot of cutting-edge topics, and there's a heading for Bigfoot and ETs, and people can follow some of the stuff we've been doing there.
It sounds like, Mary, your next book is formulating as we talk.
It could be. I'm certainly interested in it at the moment. But it confirms all this ancient theories that we have, and it's wonderful, alive support that we have for the theories.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. My guests today have been Mary Joyce. Her book is Cherokee Little People Were Real. You can get it on Amazon. And I believe I will post her website on the Facebook page. And we also had Dr. Susan Martinez, who wrote the book, The Lost History of the Little People, the Spiritually Advanced Civilizations Around the World. Thank you both for being with me. I really enjoyed today's program. And and by the way, Susan's book is available on Amazon, and you also can download it on her publisher's website, which is Inner Traditions, who has been a sponsor with us. And they just opened and released a new website, which is all digitally focused. So you can download the book as a digital format also. So wonderful, wonderful books. Thank you both.
I really enjoyed being on the show, and I hope we all keep doing what we're doing, because that's the way the information will get out there.
Yes, yes. Before I jump off, I'll ask each of you if you're going to be speaking anywhere this fall or winter, just to let our audience know where they can hear you live. Go ahead, Mary.
As far as a live audience, I have two things coming up, and they're all very local. There's a book fair at the Jackson County Silva Library coming up on a Saturday. I think it's the 14th. And
mm-hmm.
then Friday in December, I think it's the 3rd or the 4th, I will be at the Henderson County Heritage Museum. And
okay.
that's part of their Walk on Main holiday festival.
Okay. And Susan, are you going to be talking or lecturing in the future?
No, but I'd like to talk to you after the show if I can.
Oh, of course. I will check back with you. So, well, that's it for today's program. Again, thank you both. I enjoyed our conversation. And as a reminder, next week our program will include Jesus Gamarra, which will be a pre-recording, but he is in Peru. This is one of the rare opportunities to hear from one of the experts on the megaliths of Peru. Specifically Cusco and Sacsayhuama, which is a megalithic site. And what's unique about the ruins is that the level of precision in the works are unimaginable. They have never been able to, in any scientific journal or any research, to figure out how they were constructed. Some believe that the technology was available thousands of years ago that was able to melt stone and allow the formation of stone into blocks, into walls, and to make homes and things like that. So that's next week with Jesus Gamarra. I hope you have a great day, and thank you for joining me.